Welcome back, everyone, to Implementing a Data Warehouse with SQL Server 2012 Jumpstart. I'm George Squillace. I'm here with my colleague, Rich Curry. Lots of good stuff up in this next session. Before I pass the football to you, Rich, I just want to give a shout out to our project manager, Elise.
Yeah, we couldn't have done it without her.
And the wizards behind the multimedia gear, some heavy gear, Danny and Barry.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
So, Rich, what's up in this module?
Well, we've been talking about data flow. Data flow is the middle part of the ETL process, but you know what? A data flow is only one piece of what can be a pretty complex workflow that may involve things like sending emails, like accessing FTP sites, going out and looping through files in a directory, all sorts of stuff that is peripheral to the actual process of extracting data, transforming it, and loading it, but is as integral a part of the process as any data flow can be. That's called control flow. So what we're headed into in this module is an overview that's going to talk about all of the different containers that are available, the tasks that they can contain that get executed. We're going to talk about how to tie these tasks together and control the sequence of execution with precedence constraints. We're going to deal with the ability to pass information from one task to another, or from one package to another, or just from an external environment to the package itself, variables and parameters. And last but certainly not least, George, checkpoints and transactions, being able to control whether or not data is actually saved and whether or not we can pick up in the middle of a flow if it breaks.
There you go.
So let's start off with containers and tasks. Containers and tasks are the two pieces that we use to develop a workflow. The containers to take a series of tasks and treat them as a single unit, and the tasks themselves that define the pieces of work that we're going to do. So some of the common tasks that we deal with, well, there are execute tasks. Execute SQL is going to give us the ability to create an SQL command and pass it out to an RDBMS system for execution. Now, the nature of the command deals with the nature of the connection. If it's a SQL server, it's going to be a T-SQL. If it is non-SQL server, it's going to be another language. We also have the ability to develop modular workflows by creating individual packages that encapsulate a series of tasks that maybe has to execute in three or four different processes. Excuse me. We have a task called the execute package task, where we can now configure it to go out, grab a different SSIS package, and force that to run in our workflow. So we have the ability to build a package to accomplish a specific process and then to use that process in many other separate processes. We also have, speaking of process, the execute process task. Execute process allows us to go out and get a non-SSIS executable and cause that to execute. Maybe it's going to be to open up a file using an application. Maybe there is an executable that goes out and reaches out to an application to get data, whatever it might be. Then we have the file system task. File system task is one of those that gets used quite a bit, because if you think, there are a whole lot of different areas where people bring Excel files, CSV files, Word documents, whatever they might be, and they drop them to be processed at a later point. The file system task gives us the ability to manage those external files. Maybe we're going to copy them to a new location. Maybe we're going to create a new directory to move them into. Whatever it might be, that's where the file system task goes. We then have one which is real important. You need to know this task, the send mail task. Send mail is for notification. Now, many times when you've got a notification, you need to tell people when something fails, when something is completed. The send mail task allows you to send that email out so that other folks are aware of when that process is completed.
Super useful.
Yeah, it requires an SMTP connection manager.
No surprise.
No, but SMTP is pretty easy. Mm-hmm. You need the IP address of the SMTP server, and you need potentially, depending on configuration, some authentication information.
Sure.
Finally, you've got a task grouping. Now, I got to tell you, George, this is not an actual task. It doesn't accomplish anything. Task grouping is more about design than it is anything else. Task grouping allows me to take a series or a group of tasks and associate them visually in the editor so that I can hide them or move them around as a unit rather than having to deal with them one by one. So if you've got a large workflow that has 50, 60, 100, 200 tasks, you can group them into units so that you're not constantly scrolling all over the place. Collapse each group and then just expand it when you're working with the tasks in that group. Now, along with the common tasks, we have a series of containers. And these, unlike groups, are actual execution issues. So I have a sequence container. A sequence container takes a series of tasks and turns it into a single execution unit so that the success or failure of all of them together is determined by the success or failure of each individual one. So no longer are we talking about each individual task as its own, but grouping them together for execution purposes so that only when they've all completed would I move on. Next, we have the for loop. For loop, if you're a developer, if you've done any coding, you've probably run into a for loop before. The for loop allows you to create an iteration. So I may have three or four tasks in there that are going to run repeatedly. A for loop, you define how many times you want to run through it. A starting point and ending point determines a set number of executions. Now, set number of executions, I'm going to give you an example here. If I have Excel files that are being dropped in a directory, George.
Sure.
Let's say I've got 10 sales reps out there, and their job is on Friday of every week, by 5 p.m., they need to drop that Excel file in a directory so that I can import it into the data warehouse. Maybe they're putting their next 2 weeks' forecast
there.
So Fred is a sales rep. And Fred is at a client until 5:15 on Friday. My other 9 sales reps got their files there, but Fred didn't. So if I were expecting 10 files and only 9 of them show up, what's that going to do to my for loop?
Kaboom.
That would be right. It is a goner. It's going to look for that 10th iteration. No file there. Done. So instead of a for loop, I have a for each loop. The for each loop iterates through a collection. A collection of files, a collection of objects, a collection of things that you can think of. Anything that you can iterate through, you can have a for each loop to do it. And all of them contain a series of tasks. You define the tasks that are going to be looped through. So what do you think, George?
Let's go.
Shall we go take a look at it?
Yeah, give us a tour.
All right. So here I've got a workflow. And in this workflow, I'm going to zoom out a little bit so you can see it's not exactly just a simple one. It's got a for loop. It's got a sequence container. It goes out and sends an email, creates a folder, and I apologize, the graphic's a little bit tough to read. But as you can see, when you zoom out to the point where you can read it, it gets, now you can't see the whole workflow. But the key here is that in my for loop, I've got an open file. Kind of the situation we were talking about, where I'm going to go through and I'm going to grab a file and do something with it. Well, if I go into my for loop, you can see I've got a fixed set of expressions. The initial expression, which is where the starting point, the eval, when it's going to stop, and what you do at the end of every loop, the assign expression. So this is going to go through from 1 to 4. Now, what happens if one of those files is missing, George?
What's going to happen?
It's going to blow up.
Uh-oh.
So having a fixed number of iterations is not what I want. I am going to replace that with a for each loop. And now I can configure in the for each loop the collection that I want it to use. I've got a series of different kinds. I can do a file enumerator. I can do an item enumerator where I define what the item is. I can do an ADO enumerator where I give it a source object. An ADO enumerator deals with records in a record set. I have an ADO.net schema row set to go through the schemas in a database. So I could process all of the tables in each schema, for example. I also have a variable enumerator to loop through a series of variables, a node list, and a server management objects iterator, which collects to the connects to the SQL server management objects. So for a for each file enumerator, there are a couple of things you're going to put in here. Number one, you're going to specify the folder that it's going to point to. And this is real straightforward. It's just a browser, pick it, and off you go. I'm going to leave it on that C drive. And then you specify the pattern for the files that it wants to hit. If I wanted all Excel files, I could say XLSX, for example. And it's going to grab only those files with that extension. And then I can tell it, do I want to use retrieve the name and extension, just the fully qualified path, or just the name. And I can even, George, ask it to go down and grab all the subfolders if I want.
Recursion.
I love recursion. It makes it easy. And then finally, I choose the variable that I want to put the value into and the index point of it. When I'm all done, I hit OK. And I have now configured my loop container. It's going to put the file name into the fname variable. I now populate and drag any tasks that I want into that for each loop and deal with it.
So everything, task I drag in there, it'll loop through whatever files happen to be in that folder with a variable number of objects.
Exactly. So if there's 5 files there, it'll loop 5 times. If there's 25 files there, it loops 25 times. You don't need to worry about it.
Good programming resiliency.
I like that.
Excellent.
I like that a lot.
Well, we have more to look at along the lines of workflow. So precedence constraints come up next, Rich.
So when we're talking about precedence constraints, a precedence constraint, very simply, we've got multiple tasks to execute in a workflow. Right, George?
Sure.
And each of those tasks, typically you have to do task 1 before you do task 2. Because there are dependencies.
Absolutely.
If I have files in directory A and I'm processing them from directory B, I need to make sure they get moved from A to B first. So what the order that things happen is determined by the precedence constraints. Now you've got two kinds. You've got very simple ones, which are just drag and drop. And you've got more complex ones where you can put in expressions where it's not just dependent on a task status. Maybe it's dependent on a piece of information in a variable as to whether or not it's going to run as well. Now, the simple constraints, very simply, every task that you configure in the control flow is going to have an arrow. You grab the arrow, you drag it and drop it on the task that you want to run next. And then you have a choice, George.
What's the choice?
The choice is, do I want it to run as soon as the previous task is done? Do I want it to run only if the previous task completes successfully? Or do I want it to run only if the previous task runs unsuccessfully? As an example, I have a task that copies files from directory A to directory B. When that task is completed, I'm then going to take those files and put them into a data flow. Now, if the copy happens successfully, I want to run the data flow, right?
Yep.
If the copy runs unsuccessfully, is there any sense in doing the data flow?
No.
No, because the files aren't there. But what would make sense is to now send an email to somebody saying that the copy failed. So now I put in my file system task and I create a data flow task. I connect it with a success precedence. I put in a send mail task. I connect it with the failure precedence. Now here's the cool part, George.
The cool part is?
If I don't connect any tasks, guess what?
What's that?
They run at the same time. If I've got four tasks and none of them are connected to each other, they're going to run in parallel. But if I've got two tasks that need to run, and then the third one runs, and finally I've got two tasks afterwards, I can have multiple predecessors, I can have multiple successors to any task.
Nice.
Lots
of control. And speaking of control, it goes even crazier than that.
Yeah, it does, because I gotta tell you, having a dependency from one task to the other is cool, but sometimes it's not enough. Sometimes I may have an external dependency, maybe a variable where a value needed to be set to a specific value in order to trigger the next flow. Maybe I've got a package where when that package is executed, the IDE or the user or whoever is causing it to run has the ability to set a parameter value that says, if it's one, I want to do this. If it's two, I want to do that. If it's three, I want to do something else. It's a choice, a conscious decision being made by the person executing. So now I can add in a condition over and above a previous task that's going to go out, check the parameter value, and only if the previous task completed and the value is 3, is it going to go do this next one. Okay? So, let's flip over, take a look at what we got here. I am going to illustrate very quickly. We have some of further on, shall we say, dependencies here.
There you go.
This first one, if you look, we have a connection between our for each loop and our sequence container. And the color of the connection, you can see it in the GUI, is green. Now, I am going to throw something out here because it's important for people to know. There are a lot of folks out there that are colorblind, so you're not going to be able to just look at those connectors and see green, red, or, and we had this argument yesterday, either blue or black on completion. Because I got to tell you, George and I went back and forth for at least 5 minutes trying to figure out, is it blue or is it black? Okay, now, this is black. That's blue. It wasn't as obvious. So if you are colorblind, let's go back to the VM. I'm going to show you the trick. You right-click on it, and it will tell you success, failure, completion with the check mark. And guess what? That's the way that you choose it as well.
The condition's what matters, not the color.
Absolutely. And no, for those of you that are wondering, it is not configurable for color. All right, so we've chosen our success condition here, and you can see down here, I've got my blue, is it blue, is it black arrow? If I look, and it does say the word completion right on top of it. So another indicator, without having to right-click on it, it does indicate failure, completion. Now, some of these are solid lines, some are dotted lines.
Curious.
Yeah, that's an indicator as well. The solid line means that it is a simple constraint. It is only dependent on the status of the previous task. The dotted line, however, is an indication that there are multiple constraints involved here. It's not just the sequence container failed. So let's take a look at this particular constraint right here, which is failure. I right-click on it, and I'm going to choose edit this time, George.
Fun.
And you can see that I now have here an evaluation operation of constraint. I'm going to go in and change it to expression and constraint. Now, I designate, is it a logical or, is it a logical and? Either one is okay. But I specify now my expression. And this is where I could go out and say, for example, I only want this to fire if counter is greater than, what did I do? I double-clicked, didn't I?
You just overtyped, no problem.
Yeah, we'll fix that. Drag it in again.
Perfect.
Is greater than 5. So now I've set up a condition where I've got two conditions that are in play. They both must be true. If the previous task fails and the value of the counter variable is greater than 5, we have the next task, which is our send failure notification that's going to run.
There you go.
And you can see the FX right next to it that tells you you have an expression condition in there as well. Cool?
Very cool.
All right. So what do we have coming up next, sir?
And next up, we have variables and parameters, some other ways that we can make packages dynamic.
You mean now I get to explain all of that stuff I've been talking about with the variables?
Well, you dropped some hints earlier. You told us more was coming up, so now the time has come.
Okay. All right. Let's drop into it. Variables and parameters, they're very similar. Okay? A variable is a storage location inside the package that's going to store a value. It requires a name. It requires that you have a data type. It requires that you have a I'm messed up here.
Initial
I got
value.
Confused.
Name,
thank
data
you.
Type.
An initial value. It has a length in some cases, depending on what it is. It can have, and it stores a piece of information. Now, there are a couple of kinds of variables. You've got system variables, which are predefined by SSIS. They can store information like the execution time, like the username, the name of the package, and some of those GUIDs.
Package ID, execution ID.
Yeah, 16-bit hexadecimal numbers that are guaranteed random. I hate looking at them. They're way too long. They all start with the prefix of the word system and then colon, colon, the name of the variable. They're easy, but I'm not done. I can create my own. Those are going to start with user colon, colon, and will follow with the name of the variable. And then I give it the scope, which is what executables are going to be able to access the value. I give it its data type, and I give it its initial value.
I don't remember if you talk about scope more coming up or not.
I do, but let's define it right here and right now. So if I have a variable that's defined inside a specific data flow, for example, if I'm outside that data flow, does the variable exist?
No.
So it's limited to the scope of whatever is inside that data flow task. Now, scope can be at the task level. It can be at the container level. Scope can even be the package level.
So package-wide.
Absolutely. You are defining where that variable is going to live, and in defining where it lives, you're identifying all of the pieces of the package that are then going to be able to access the value.
Can I mention one more thing, Rich?
You can, George.
One of the things that was nasty in SSIS, pardon me, of something I didn't quite appreciate previously, is that once you defined scope in SSIS, you stepped in a bear trap and could not change it. And now there's a nice little button where you can change the scope to from task, container, package, up and down, at will.
Yes.
Very nice.
It is. It is very, very helpful.
But we have something new in 2012. What's that, Rich?
We have parameters. Now, parameters are kind of like variables at the project level, okay? A package parameter is available at the package level. It allows an external entry of a value to what's basically a variable. So, for example, I could set a file name if I had a package where I could feed the file name in. I could set the name of the file I wanted the package to run against. I also have project parameters, which now are only available, you have to be careful, if you're doing project deployment.
That's going to come up later.
It is. That's going to be mod 6, so stay tuned there. Parameters have default values. They can be set at design time. If I set it at design time and I don't change it any other way, then that design value is the one that gets used when it executes. When I deploy a package, I can assign a default value to the deployed package. Now, when I deploy, that means I'm making it available in either SQL Server or the SSIS process. And at that point, I have the ability to set that parameter value for the package. It overrides the design value and makes it available, again, to everything inside the package. And then we have one further setting. When I go to execute it, I can override that stored value. So now I've got the design default, I've got the server default, I've got the execution value, which sticks for only that one. Parameters are only available in the project deployment model, be they package level or project level.
But there are other ways to make packages dynamic.
There are. They do use parameters in many cases, and it's called property expressions. Now, if you notice, when we go back and we look at all of these control flow tasks and data flow tasks, they're all configurable, right?
Sure.
And we do that by setting property values. Maybe it's an initial counter. Maybe it's the directory to look at for a for each file enumerator. Maybe it's the name of the server where a database exists in a connection manager. Uh-oh. We've got all these properties that make values that determine the behavior of that executable, of that object. Now, a property expression allows me to dynamically set the values based on the properties of a specific object in SSIS based on a parameter or variable value. So now I don't need to know what the name of the server is when I deploy out to a particular server. I can set a property expression, which is going to go out and grab a parameter, which is populated with the server value, so that whenever that executable runs, and depending on where it runs, the property is configured based on the value of the parameter. Okay? Let's go out and take a quick gander at something here. And I think what I'm going to do is, let's see. I've got a connection manager here. And my connection manager, I'm going to double click on it. That brings up the editor. We can see the usage type and all that. But you know what? I'm also going to go out to edit. I'm not getting it on that one. I got to get it on, where is it? I'm not getting it there. I should be getting it there.
Remind me, what were you looking for?
I should have been getting some property expressions on there. So we'll flip over here to the file system task editor because
sure.
I'll be able to get it on that one.
Or go to the properties pane, one or the other.
Yep, but here's the key is we've got two pages. We've got the general, which has the regular normal entry of values into those editors, and we have expressions. When I go into expressions, I click on the ellipsis, and now I get to choose the property. Let's say that I'm going to look at a is the source path variable, the name, for example, and I can go in, and now I've got my variables and parameters together. I can take and I can drop it into the expression. I hit OK, and now dynamically the name property will now take on the value of user :: F name.
And I saw that expression editor, Rich, so that means you have all the things available, parameters, variables, functions, conversion functions.
Absolutely.
You know,
the only thing you can't access, depending on where you are, is you will not be able to access information in the data flow. This is only to be able to access parameters and variables. So what do we got coming up now, George?
Next, we're going to look at maintaining package integrity, checkpoints, and transactions. But I know you have a lot to talk about there.
You know, this is actually one of my favorite topics. Whenever you've got a complex workflow, there is at least a possibility that something may not go right.
Might not.
I don't know about you. I don't get that too much. I really do, you know, make packages that work right every time.
You're Captain Wonderful. But there are other factors, too.
Oh, yeah. No. Sometimes it's outside of my control.
Absolutely.
I admit it. But checkpoints and transactions are two ways that we can manage the behavior of our packages, the behaviors of our data flow, when it comes to persisting data into the destination. That's really what it's all about. We have two scenarios here. One is the data flow is interrupted midstream with a problem, and we want everything that's already happened to stay happened and then pick up where we left off.
Perfect.
The other scenario is I've gotten partway through my flow and everything that's happened has to be successfully completed with everything that hasn't happened. So I can't let what's been done stay done. I need to undo it. And that's what checkpoints and transactions accomplish.
So you have some more detail here for these.
Yep. Checkpoints are files that are created by SSIS while the package is running that keep track of what has been completed by the package. So if I have a 10-step data flow or a 10-step control flow that includes three different data flows, and I get through step 7, and then I get a failure. A checkpoint can record the fact that step 7 was completed, but step 8 never finished and had to be undone. Now, when I restart that package, George, and run it a second time, it reads that file, skips the first 7 steps because they've been done.
That's right.
And picks up with 8 and finishes through. When you've got long-running packages that are working with a lot of data, checkpoints can really, really, really help you to not have to repeat things.
Sure, let's say I just spent 2 hours FTPing a bunch of files. The files downloaded fine, but something with further processing failed. You know, why re-download 2 hours worth of files?
Absolutely correct. Absolutely correct. It saves you from repeating significant chunks of work that were already successfully done. Now, packages are configurable. You have to tell the package if it's going to use checkpoints. The default is that it will not use checkpoints. But you can configure it to use a checkpoint file if one exists, or you can configure it to require a checkpoint file. Now, the difference between those two is that if it doesn't exist, SSIS will assume that it starts from the beginning of the flow and will only look at that checkpoint file as a restart if the file exists. If you do require it, then that file must be there at all times. So if you have a workflow where it's going out to a directory that's outside of your control, I recommend using if exists as the setting, because you can't really, you're not in control of whether somebody's going to delete that file. If the directory is under your control, then you've got a much more reasonable choice. Now, the other piece of this is transactions. Now, a transaction is a unit of work that must succeed or fail as a unit. Now, think of this, George. You've got two bank accounts in two separate banks. So you go into Bank A and you fill out a transfer slip that says, I want to move $1,000 from A to B. You'd go and they withdraw the money from A and send it off to B. Everything works fine. Everybody's happy. But let's assume for a minute that it came out of A, went to B, and B wasn't able to deposit it. Now, if B doesn't tell A that it didn't get the money, what happens?
Uh-oh, mismatch.
You're out $1,000. Are you a happy boy?
Not happy.
Okay, let's go the other way. A goes to withdraw it. It fails. B deposits it anyway. Who's happy now?
Nice.
Yeah, George just got $1,000. But the bank that he took it from is probably not going to be thrilled with him. A transaction can wrap those two behaviors together so that if either one of them fails, then neither one of them works. And that's the way I like to look at it. It's an all or nothing.
Good description.
Transactions exhibit what are called the ACID properties. They are atomic, which means they cannot be broken down any further into finer levels of independent work. And that's the key, independent.
Mm-hmm.
They are consistent, which means when everything's done, the answers that you expect are the ones that are there. They are isolated, which means nothing else can touch the data while the transaction is working with the data. And they are durable because when it's done, it's permanent and it can't be undone. You can set up transactions at any container level. You can set it up at the package level, at a sequence container, at a loop container. You can even set them up at a task level. The settings, there are three of them. They can be required, which means it will always start a new transaction when it gets there. They can be supported, which means if there's a transaction, it will join it. And they can be not supported, which means even if there's a transaction out there, I don't care. I'm not going to deal with it. I am ignoring you.
And you have some things to show, too.
Why, yes. Yes, I do. Let us now go into another demo I've got here, which is going to, come on now, there you go. I've got a package here called load data. Load data has three steps in it, a create folder step, a copy file step, and a load to staging table. Now, I want this to use checkpoints. I want it to be able to pick up if something happens. So the first thing I need to do is I need to display the properties. So I'm going to go up to view, properties window. And now when I click anywhere in the background, I get my package property. In my package properties, right up at the top, when you're in category view of the properties, is the checkpoint properties. I've got checkpoint file name, checkpoint usage, and save checkpoints. Now, first thing I'm going to tell you is if you're going to use checkpoints, this has to be true. Otherwise, there's no sense in doing it. Then I configure my usage. Never, if exists, or always. Yep. I'm going to set up an if exists. I'm now going to go to my checkpoint file name, and I'm going to specify where that checkpoint is going to live. I'm going to put it down here in my D directory under the checkpoints, right where the package is. And I'm going to call it loaddata.chk. Now, I used a convention there. It's not a requirement. That chk can be absolutely any extension that you can think of.
I've seen that before, though.
But it's an easy one.
Yeah.
It's easy because it indicates that it's a checkpoint file, and people are going to recognize that. So I open it. Now, guess what I need to do next, George?
What's next?
I need to actually configure each of these tasks so that the checkpoint will occur.
There you go.
So each task has a property called fail parent on failure. And you can see the default value of that is false. That means that if that individual task were to fail, the parent would just keep right on trucking. The parent in this case is the package. I've also got fail package on failure, which will do the exact same thing. If you set that one on subtasks, maybe I have tasks inside containers, then even if one that's three or four levels down fails, it doesn't matter what its parents are set to, it'll just fail the package. So you set that for all your critical tasks.
Super granular.
Absolutely. I set that to true, and now the package will fail if the task is unsuccessful. I'm going to do that for all three steps because these are all critical steps. Now notice I'm just double clicking and I'm changing it. You can use the drop down, but when you got toggle switches like that, it's easier to double click sometimes.
That's a good trick to show.
Yeah, I like that one. So now I'm going to start debugging. It goes in and that's interesting. It thought the file was already there.
Interesting.
Because it skipped over the first two. Now, I'm looking here, and I've got no green checks and a red X. So there must have been a checkpoint file out there already that I didn't see. So let's go out to the file system. I'm going to kill out of the debugger. I'm going to go to the file system. We're going to go to our D drive, 1077, demo 6. I get the wrong one there. Sorry about that. Nope.
No, there was the checkpoints folder.
But I got to find the right spot. There it is.
And there's the checkpoint.
There it is. I'm going to delete that so that it's not there. And now when we run it, you can see the first two ran, the third one didn't. So that just goes to show you, if that checkpoint file exists, and I didn't catch the fact that it was already there when I set this up, it will, it will use that checkpoint file. So a great way on the if exists is to get rid of the checkpoint file. When I close this, we are going to go back to that directory. I should have kept that open, shouldn't I, George?
That's all right.
Yeah, it only takes a second. On 5 checkpoints. There's my load data check. Let's go take a look at what's in there.
Now you're playing Curious George.
A little bit. And look, it is an XML file. And that XML file has things like the fact that it is a DTS checkpoint, the namespace, the package ID. It's got variables like container ID, the result, the DTS result. That's how it keeps track of where it was. As long as that file is there, I go back to run this a second time, and now you can see it reads the content of the file. It picks up with
Perfect.
The tasks that were already there.
So a folder was made, a bunch of files were FTP'd or copied from some other process, but the failure occurred after that. Why repeat that initial work?
Absolutely correct. So let's take a look at one more thing in here, because we talked about transactions.
Yep.
So let's go back in here and take a look at how to set them up.
All right.
So what I'm going to do is, again, I'm going to go to the package level. And at the package level, I'm going to look for a property. And give me a second here, because I don't have them all memorized.
There's only thousands.
Yeah, there's only thousands. There's my transaction option. Now, if you look at the transaction option, the initial value is supported. So if this were to get called from another package that was in the midst of a transaction, then it would use that transaction. It would join into it and become a part of it. If I want this package to create a transaction, I'm now going to choose the value required. That means, whoops, what did I do?
I don't know.
I must have misclicked.
We saw required though.
Yeah, that should have gone in there though. Not supported works, but required is not showing.
I wonder if maybe it needs a parent package
property or something like that. Save checkpoints or transactions. You know, the two are mutually exclusive. I forgot about that. So let's go back up here to our save checkpoints, set it to false. Now I can go in and I can set my not supported required.
Perfect.
And we're good. It'll still use a checkpoint file if it's there, but it's not necessarily going to save things. Now that I've got required, I can go into my individual tasks and I can change each one. Now again, the default value for each task is supported. So when I configure the individual package, it will automatically, all of the control flow tasks in it will join that transaction. If any one of them fail, then they all will fail and it will undo the work that was done. Now, here I am, I'm talking about create folder, copy file, load to staging table. Those aren't all database stuff, are they?
No.
But yet I can still put a transaction on there.
Mm-hmm.
Transactions are not just for databases. There is a service that's available within Windows called the Distributed Transaction Coordinator. The Distributed Transaction Coordinator is an external process that Windows, that SQL Server, that many different services and servers can talk to, even on separate boxes, that can coordinate the activities from one machine, from one process to another. Then, when an individual process is successful, the DTC is notified of that success. When all of the processes are successful, it sends that notification back to wherever the processes that were involved in the transaction live. Once they're all successful, we get commit, everything happens. If any of them fail, we come back out of it, and none of them work.
There you go.
All right, so we talked about a lot in this module, didn't we?
Lots of dev stuff.
Yeah, we define the control flow and the workflow elements that go into it and how to connect them together, how to set up conditional execution.
Containers.
We talked about containers with for each loops and for loops and sequence. We talked a little bit about grouping and how that works for the ability to work with things. And then we went into package control from the standpoint of checkpoints and transactions, how to combine and how to interrupt, setting up the dependencies and how to stop it in the midstream and be able to pick it up again later.
That's a handful. I bet everybody's ready for a break.
I know I am.
Well, thanks everybody for continuing with us on implementing a data warehouse with SQL Server 2012 Jumpstart. Let's take a 10-minute stretch or so. We'll see you back at the top of the hour.